Let's go. We're coming. Okay, our next speaker is Glenn Marsh from Grove City College, and he will be talking about exploring extraterrestrial creation, theology, and ethics of space exploration.
All right, thank you. My lifetime almost exactly spans the American human spaceflight program since I was born almost to the hour. I was born in the hour when Alan Shepard rocketed off into space May 5th, 1961. My mother was on the operating table getting a C-section, and there were TVs in the operating room because the nurses and doctors were watching the TV, about which she was not very happy, told me so. But I have been a certifiable space cadet since the second I've been born. That's never left me. And so I want to talk about that, because I've always been a big proponent of space flight, and yet, as a Christian, I feel like I need to take seriously what human sin and the fall is and has done to us in terms of how I think some warnings that we should approach it. So my talk in many ways is going to be much more pessimistic than I actually am about space flight, but I think it's important to think through some of these things. So I want to start with where we were a long time ago. We just celebrated the landing of the Eagle on the Sea of Tranquility by Armstrong and Aldrin. I just wrote a column about that for our college. But the thing to remember is that one of the reasons why we never explored space very much after this is because Apollo is never about space exploration. Not really. While there were some people who hoped that would propel us, humanity, into space, it really never did, because Apollo is about beating the Soviets in this existential Cold War. And that's really what it was about, and we spent enormous amounts of money for this. Many of the astronauts, probably most of them, didn't care much about space. John F. Kennedy even said in a meeting with NASA kahunas, they're talking through this, trying to get the money, John F. Kennedy said, "I'm not that interested in space." Most of the astronauts said much the same thing. Jim Lovell, commander of Apollo 13, said, "Look, that was the next up on my professional development. And I became an astronaut, and they selected me, and I went to the moon." We were on the cusp of going to Mars. Wernher von Braun planned a Mars mission in 1981. That was the plan. We developed nuclear thermal rockets called Project Nerevit. We developed a number of these engines. They worked splendidly. They developed twice the impulse of chemical rockets. An impulse is a standard a metric of rocket efficiency. And they were double the efficiency of chemical rockets, about equal thrust. We had planned to use those to send astronauts to Mars, and my students are very surprised when I tell them that Mars missions were planned for the early 1980s, but the check was canceled. It was very expensive, and to do that, they would have had to continue the equivalent 4.4% of the gross national product, whatever it was about 4%, and that was just too much. In a bipartisan move, really, Congress canceled the check for NASA and therefore for Project Nerevit. So there's been a long hiatus in spaceflight. We did have the space shuttle for a number of years, a very, very finicky, dangerous machine that killed 14 astronauts, two missions out of 150. The space shuttle was retired in 2011. It really was not a reusable system. It cost $500 million per mission by the end of its time. Now we do have rockets. The space industry is still a big thing, but for the most part, it's unmanned. We use rockets for mill space applications, for telecommunications, for science payloads. These have been expendable rockets. The Delta Heavy has been, until recently, the world's largest rocket in terms of payload in low Earth orbit, about 29,000 kilograms or metric tons. Now, one interesting development was that President Obama initiated the commercial crew program as part of the commercial orbital transportation system. And so basically trying to privatize human access to space. That has actually led to a number of beneficial things. And I want to stop here and think about why people want to go to space. And you'll notice these are mostly negative questions or can be taken that way. But they're important because I'm going to segue into talking about commercial space development. And these entrepreneurs who want to get us into space have their reasons for doing so, questions that perhaps they ask. Do we want to go to space because we're explorers by nature? I think we are, because we have an impulse to seek a Messiah. You'll, if you're a science fiction reader, you'll know that's that is one of the motifs, one of the genres of science fiction. They are wiser than us because they've survived long enough to become interstellar species. They have much to teach us. And a lot of that is that people recognize that humanity is a sticky wicket. Call it a fall, call it evil, you know, whatever you want. People recognize that there needs to be something above us, but may not want to recognize Christ as that Messiah. Do we want to subjugate others? Many may not say that explicitly, but yet we know the history of our own exploration. Is it because we want to prevent species extinction? And you will find out that this is one of the biggest impetuses for human spaceflight. And I'm going to give you two examples of people who want to do this. The movie Interstellar is about that. The trailer they had for that is, you know, humanity's been in its cradle, but our planet is dying. We need to leave this cradle, our planet, to go into space. So there are a lot of things you can ask about. Why do people really want to go to space? So we come to two examples of space visionaries. These names are probably well known to you. They have their own reasons for going to space. And one of the nice things about it is that they don't care about public opinion very much. And this is important because NASA was never popular. People don't get this, but there's a lot of money, and people didn't want to spend that kind of money. And that was a very bipartisan criticism, sometimes for different reasons, but it was. Only after Apollo 11 did public opinion soar above 50%. You have to be a sour of us, right? Put somebody on the moon and not appreciate it at some point. But they don't care. They want to go to space for their own reasons. Elon Musk wants humanity to become an interplanetary species. He wants to go to Mars. He wants to go to Mars and be buried personally on Mars one day. He thinks that Mars is a fixer-upper planet, and he thinks that one of humanity's goals is to go to Mars and terraform Mars and convert it into an Earth-like paradisal planet one day. And Jeff Bezos says he's founder of Amazon.com, but he spends $1 billion of his money every year gratis on this company, Blue Origin. And Jeff Bezos is a disciple of MIT engineer Eugene O'Neill. Gerard O'Neill, excuse me. And Gerard O'Neill had a different vision. Gerard O'Neill said humanity will live in rotating space habitats that we now call O'Neill cylinders. And then really what you want to do is get humanity to the asteroids and mine the asteroids. The asteroids are plentiful in resources. If you think about how much precious metal the asteroid Psyche 209 contains, it's mind-boggling. And the nice thing about asteroids is they're not deep gravity wells. They're easy to get off of, hop on and off of. So he thinks that humanity isn't going to really settle on dry, dusty planets like Mars, but it's going to become a race of belters, people who live in the asteroid belt, mining the asteroids. That's where Jeff Bezos wants to go. And they're both working towards that. Elon Musk has created, with his engineers, by the way, run by Gwynne Shotwell, who's really the brains behind the actual business aspect of it, but they've developed a series of Falcon rockets, including the Falcon 9 Block 5, which is what they use to launch payloads under 23 metric tons. And he has a capsule that is human-rated that will ferry astronauts to space into the International Space Station called Crew Dragon. And he's developed the Falcon Heavy rocket, which is now the world's leader in payload. 63 metric tons to low Earth orbit is possible with the Falcon Heavy. And he's building hardware for the super heavy Starship stacked configuration, which he sees as taking us to the Moon and Mars and to wherever else you want to go. He's working on that, and there are two locations building competing versions of this, one in Florida and one in Texas. Now, Jeff Bezos is more secretive. Elon Musk is kind of out there as a public persona, Jeff Bezos not so much. But he has developed the New Shepard space tourism rocket. If you've got $75,000 burning a hole in your pocket, you can go and you can fly above the Kármán line, 100 kilometers, and come back and be officially labeled an astronaut. But that's suborbital. That's not orbital. But he's building the New Glenn booster, which would loft 40 metric tons into orbit. That's a pretty heavy launch rocket. And he also is developing the BE-4 engine to power that, which is also going to power other engines that United Launch Alliance is making. But anyway, they're both synthesis. They're both creating a lot of hardware. They're ready to go. And I tell my students, I was disappointed. We didn't really become a human space-faring species after Apollo. Even with the shuttle, we really weren't. But this is different now. These people are serious, and they don't care about whether 51% of congressional votes, what they do. So I want to talk about C.S. Lewis and his criticisms of spaceflight, because, I'll say this, we have this idea of Lewis as being this affable guy who met with the Inklings and the Elephant and Castle, and they talked about stuff. Lewis had a really hard edge, and he was highly pessimistic of the possibility and potential of human spaceflight. So I'm going to talk about that using a couple of Lewis's works, some of which aren't well known. I'll talk about two poems, and then another one called Religion and Rocketry. So we'll start with a Prelude to Space and Epithalamium. And that's spelled two different ways because Lewis, being a Latin scholar, used the direct Latin word, and the one the English majors use doesn't have the I. But an Epithalamium is a beautiful poem of a bride walking to her bridal chamber, getting ready to consummate the marriage. It's a very intimate term. By the way, a little bit of this is not suitable for work, in a way. Lewis wrote this, right? We got to come to terms with what he really thought on it. So that's the poem. It's a marriage poem to fulfill the marriage, consummate the marriage. It was probably written as a response, not only probably, it was written as a response to Arthur C. Clarke's A Prelude to Space, in which he talks about, very excitingly, right, about the future of human exploration. And Lewis liked and respected Clarke, and vice versa. They had a good relationship. But he did not like Clarke's vision. It was far too optimistic for him, so he wrote this poem. And the basic idea behind the poem is humanity is going to space as a rapist. Okay, that's really what he meant. It's not the positive side of a loving consummation of a marriage, but rather it is humanity as a rapist. And this is kind of bold. I know this is kind of crass, it seems like. This is what it says. From the first stanza, so man grown vigorous now holds himself ripe to breed, daily devises how to ejaculate his seed and boldly fertilize the black womb of the unconsenting skies. I mean, C.S. Lewis wrote that, right? I mean, that he did. He was very harsh about these things because he knew what human nature was about. And we are already polluting space, by the way. There's a tremendous amount of space debris orbiting the Earth. This is actually from the NASA Orbital Debris Program Office. They track all this stuff, and you see the shroud of white around the Earth. These are all these hypervelocity particles from crashed satellites, from when you launch a satellite, flecks and pieces come off. You've got dead satellites all together. The Earth is covered, the skies around the Earth are covered with these things. They even postulate the Kessler effect, which when you have enough debris in space, you get collisions more and more rapidly, which renders more collisions more and more rapidly until basically it becomes uninhabitable. So we are, and we now recognize this is a real problem. Space is not infinite. You have to figure out how to deorbit satellites and get that rid of that stuff. Another poem he wrote is called An Expostulation Against Too Many Science Fiction Writers. And here he says, look, you guys, look, all you're doing here is having this huge big tableau of galaxies and interplanetary planets and whatever. All you're doing is just transporting the same old human sin, same old human mythologies into a new tableau that you're writing about. And if at the journey's end we find the same old stuff we left behind. Lewis was much more interested in general about what's going on here on the Earth, although as you do know, he wrote the Space Trilogy about human spaceflight, which by the way is in a novelized form, actually exemplifies all these pathologies that I'm talking about. Lewis's fiction mirrored what he really believed. Okay, about spaceflight. And if you've read the Space Trilogy, and I recommend that you do, you find out that humanity going into space is not viewed by him as being an unalloyed good by any means. A lot of what I'm going to talk about comes from a relatively unknown essay called Religion and Rocketry. It's found in the book The World's Last Night. So he addresses a couple of questions. Is there extraterrestrial life? And if there is, are they animals and soulish, as Hugh Ross would say, are they sentient? That's the really important thing. If there are they fallen? Or are they unfallen? And if they're fallen, how would they be redeemed? And Deb Harzner addressed a number of these kind of issues in her excellent plenary talk. Well, what Lewis, for the purpose of this talk, what I'm going to say is, why would we not want to encounter aliens? And I want to say this much. It's not what they'll do to us. I think the question we ought to ask is, what will we do to them? I think that's the issue. Lewis says in this essay, we know what our race does to strangers. Man destroys or enslaves every species he can. He says, what that will be if they meet things weaker than themselves, the black man and the red man can tell. If they meet things, get this last one, if they, meaning humans, meet things stronger, they will be very properly destroyed. Let me go over that. This is important. What Lewis is saying there is, if we meet a weaker species, we'll enslave it. We'll mistreat it. If we meet a stronger unfallen species, they, right properly, will destroy us. Now, think about where he's coming from. In Paralandra, the second book of the Space Trilogy, Lewis decides to kill a demon-possessed man who is tempting the Eve character in that book. And that's very striking. Why did he say he's not a pacifist? He realized there was a point. Some people need killing. And this man is evil. And this is also, think of World War II, right? And our battle against the Nazis being a backdrop here. So these ideas are mirrored in the Space Trilogy. Another thing, what if we want to do better? What if we send our missionaries? Well, he addresses this. He says missionaries' records are very spotty, right? And the missionaries are going to misunderstand the extraterrestrial species. They're not going to really know how to deal with what they are and what their culture is and why they believe what they do. Can even missionaries, he says, be trusted? And he expands on that. I think Deb Harzman also recommended this book, The Sparrow, and I do too. It's really excellent. The lady who wrote it is an anthropologist at the University of Chicago. And Russell was raised Catholic and married a Jewish man, so she's now Jewish. But she writes very sensitively about religion. And in this book, this race of creatures sends radio signals. And the Jesuits sell everything they have to build a spaceship to go there just to listen. Not even the proselytize. And then from there, everything goes wrong. And the idea is, and she says this in interviews, the people who did this were not the worst, they were the best of their civilization. They were the best. They were the most educated. And in spite of that, they really screwed up royally.
Okay.
All right, so Lewis thought that vast distances, which might be a help, might keep humanity isolated. And this comes through in Out of the Sodom Planet. Earth, to him, is a quarantine planet. And maybe God made these vast distances so that we could not interact with other races. Now, I'm getting to the end here, and I want to talk about Lewis and Clark. Okay? And that's been a long-standing joke, by the way. Lewis and Clark. Now, we know Arthur C. Clarke is a science fiction writer. He was an atheist, although probably a Buddhist. And he liked Buddhism because he didn't think it was a real religion, so he was okay with it. Lewis and Clarke have disagreed on much. And a lot of what Lewis wrote was in response to Clarke's works. Clarke was a younger man. Lewis loved Clarke's science fiction, even though he thought that childhood's end was powerful. He says that Clarke doesn't have Ray Bradbury's delicacy, but he has 10 times his emotional power in reading childhood end. But Clark was a proponent of human spaceflight and a member of the British Interplanetary Society, which does still exist. Clark agreed with Lewis this much. He said if people's attitudes, which they often are what Lewis's characters are, we shouldn't go to space. Okay? There is a character in Lewis's book called Weston. Weston is a physicist who is a very bad man. And Clark observed that people were saying the same things in real life that Lewis had Weston saying in his books. And Clark is saying, if our desire for space flight is like this guy Weston, we should have nothing to do with it. We should have nothing to do with it. So he agreed, Clark agreed about imperialism, that we shouldn't go there to be imperialistic. This is a letter to Lewis that Clark wrote in 2003, not long before he died. And I thought it kind of encapsulates the relationship. I've just recalled a memory of our last only meeting. It was with the other interplanetarians, and you commented on our hopes of space exploration. I'm sure you're very wicked people, but wouldn't the world be dull if everyone was good? You had a friend with you whose name I discovered later was Tolkien or Tolkien. I wonder what happened to him. So we have to ask a couple of questions to end the talk. Do the cultural mandates in Genesis 1 apply to extraterrestrial exploration? Is it the Earth or not? How much has the fall eroded the Imago Dei? These are important things. It says, be fruitful and multiply, increase the number, multiply on the Earth. Does that mean space? I would argue that it's actually in our DNA. You can't say, I don't like the Dominion mandate because it causes us to pollute. Doesn't matter. We will explore because it's in our DNA. The question is how will we explore? And it's knowing the fallenness of us that will mitigate the effects as much as possible. And the Genesis 8:7 quote is a recapitulation of the Dominion mandate, cultural mandate, after the fall. So here that God wants us to do that. I would also submit that, unless unchecked in some way, a fallen Imago Dei creature may enjoy itself. As in fact our powers become more godlike, therefore we develop the powers to destroy ourselves if we're not careful. That may in fact be inevitable, and there's an interesting thing called the great filter I can talk to you about if you're interested. In 1945, the physicist working on the Trinity device, the A-bomb, worried that the atmosphere would ignite planet-wide. They tried to do some calculations, but that was what they actually thought about. Artificial intelligence, gray goo hypothesis, where our nanobots consume everything, so forth. We're developing high technology. We need to be really careful. To answer things like that, the space visionaries would tell you they do have altruistic reasons. There are altruistic reasons why we do things. If we could turn our world to this Edenic paradisal state, where much of our industry is done off-site, and that would actually be a very good thing. That is their vision, and I'm going to give them credit for that. If you have a high-risk, high-gain experiment you want to do in advanced physics, do it off-site. Don't do it here. If you think your experiment's going to make a black hole, you know, do it on an asteroid. You can track where the asteroid goes, right? It's got an orbit. You can figure it out. But don't do it on the Earth. Our job is as a preservative. We're salt and light. That means we're preservatives. That's the meaning of this. Tertullian applied this to Rome almost 2 millennia ago. And from his apology, which actually isn't an apology, it's an attack on the Roman way of life. He said, we know that a mighty shock impending over the whole earth, in fact, the very end of all things, threatening dreadful woes, is only retarded by the continual existence of the Roman Empire. So he says, therefore, we're praying for you. We Christians, you're persecuting us. The reason you're still around and will prosper in the future is because we're praying for the emperor and his genie and that sort of thing. We're protecting you. That's what we do. We're salt and light. You guys are salt and light in our culture to keep us from destroying ourselves. And I'll end with this slide. It's the one that I wrote on the Apollo 11 column this week. We did Apollo because of the Cold War. Why? We made these rockets originally to hurl hydrogen bombs at each other. That's what we did. They were adapted from this technology. We just put an astronaut rather than an H-bomb. But yet, when we got there, the astronauts did not talk about manifest destiny, victory on the battlefield, or making a lot of money by destroying the environment. Instead, they left a plaque on the lunar surface that read, "Here men from the planet Earth first set foot upon the moon, July 1969 AD. We came in peace for all mankind." That's my talk. Thank you. Yes.
I'm surprised at Lewis's skepticism with regard to missions, because when you think about it, sure, he realized that all of the spread of the gospel has been a result of missions. So on average, it's working.
That's
not perfect.
Tell me your idea of on average is working. I think we can say the same thing about exploration in general.
Yeah.
But the more we're aware of our sin, the bigger the pros versus cons are. Lewis is right. I mean, Lewis knew enough about the history that missions was a sticky wicket often, and we often didn't understand the cultures we were going to. And then he said also that the people who are usually first aren't always the missions. It's usually the adventurers,
yeah,
and the,
yeah,
you know, the entrepreneurs and whatnot. They don't really care about the people they're going to. Yes.
So I guess Lewis wasn't the proponent probably of SETI either, signaling trying to detect extraterrestrials, because he would feel that if we did detect superior civilization, they'd probably destroy us. I'm not a fan of SETI myself. I think that basically it's not likely they're out there or enough are out there to be close enough. It's a waste of money. But I do believe, I agree with Lewis, that if they have reproduced geometrically, like we do when we're going out, you look at what's going on in the Earth, and you have to think they might just destroy us.
Well, that was his point. I mean, that's a sad commentary on humanity. But nonetheless, I think it's insightful at any rate. I mean, SETI wasn't around then.
Yeah.
Well, but Frank Drake, not long after Lewis's death, when I actually sent some signals to Tall SETI.
Yeah.
That's when they were dying, hoping that maybe ET would answer back, and that didn't happen. But,
what's that?
Maybe they haven't. You just haven't got it back.
Well, we would have got it. Yeah, they're like within 11 light years. So it would have been, it's a very slow conversation, but we would have gotten it back.
I don't know. Time for one more question. If not, let's thank the speaker again.